danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 291 of the Thinking Poker Podcast from Baltimore, Maryland. I'm Andrew Brokus. I'll be doing your introduction solo. I'll be joined shortly by Nate Mavis in Melrose, Massachusetts, and by our guest, Mark Thompson. Mark is a software developer and a poker player who actually worked a bit with Nate on a piece of software that Mark has just recently released to make available for sale to the public called Kicker. It's actually a software that he designed when he was a beginning poker player to help him improve at poker and specifically to work on some things from Ed Miller's book Poker 1%, which we covered as part of a now defunct book review segment that we used to do on this podcast several years ago, or book club segment, I should say. So this conversation is about not just Mark's software, but about what are the kinds of things that beginning players struggle with that are important, or what are some of the conceptual misunderstandings that they have, and how can coaches and or software and studying help people to not just improve on things that not just improve specific skills, but orient themselves correctly in terms of how they should be thinking about poker and kind of reaching certain aha moments more quickly. I found it to be an interesting conversation, and I think Mark's a very personable guy, so I hope that you will both enjoy it and profit from it. I also want to let you know, if you didn't hear on the last episode, or if you've forgotten or weren't listening that closely, I forgive you. Episode 300 is coming up, and one of the things that we'd like to do on episode 300 is share your poker stories. Nate and I have always thought of this show as being first and foremost about the interesting people and also things that happen in the poker world. We've shared a lot of our own poker stories. Our guests, of course, have shared very interesting stories, and we would like to hear stories from you. And when I say stories, I guess I should warn, we're probably not interested in anything involving the way the cards ran out. So, I mean, it would have to be pretty darn good for it to be, you know, I had quads and I ended up losing to a straight flush. Like, that is, I guess I'm more interested in something that gets to the heart of what's interesting about poker, or what's funny about poker, or what you like about poker. The kind of story that you might tell even to someone who didn't necessarily know the rules of poker. It was not a very serious poker player, but still might appreciate this kind of slice of life from the poker world. There's a few ways that you can share those with us. You can type them up and email them to podcast@thinkingpoker.net. You can also, if you would like to be on the air yourself telling the story, you can visit Thinking Poker on Skype. So go to Skype, call at Thinking Poker on Skype, and you'll have the opportunity to leave us a voicemail, and there you can recite your story. Just to be clear, if you choose to do that, you are giving us permission to use your voice on the air. You're giving us permission to edit your story. You are not going to be compensated for this except in the form of our appreciation, and we will have the rights to use that audio file. #NickCast. There's going to be some strategy talk in the actual interview, so we're going to have just a short strategy segment. But first, I need to tell you about Tournament Poker Edge. Tournament Poker Edge is a great place to go to get those aha moments, or to accelerate your aha moments, which is what it's all about, really. If you study poker for 100 years, you'd probably get pretty good at it, but by the time you got good at it, you wouldn't probably be able to play anymore. Although with these advances in modern science, who knows? But probably you want to get better quicker than that, and Tournament Poker Edge is a great way to accelerate your learning process. You can sign up for as little as $25 a month at tournamentpokeredge.com. So this strategy question is kind of a general one. It's just one that we've gotten from a few different people over the years. Sometimes my students ask me about this as well. And it has to do with note-taking in a live poker setting. I mean, people are curious about two things. One is, you know, how do you get down all the important details? Like, what are sort of the logistics of doing it? But also, how do you do it in a subtle way, a way where people can't tell that you're taking notes? Which I understand why people don't want their opponents to know that they're taking notes. I mean, I think it can kind of ruin the atmosphere of a game a little bit, or certainly change your image at the table. It makes you seem like a more serious student of poker. It may kind of convey to some of your opponents that, you know, this isn't just all fun and games. You know, some people here are taking this very seriously, and that can undermine the mood that you want to create at the table. So I understand that part. What I've never fully understood is why people think their opponents are going to realize what they're doing. I suppose if you have out like a pad and paper, people will assume if you like write on it after every hand that you're involved in that you're taking notes. But if you're just doing something on like a phone or a tablet, I don't know, it feels very standard to me that you know, plenty of people are on their phones in between hands at a poker table, or when there's a pot going on that they're not involved in, people are on their phones. That seems entirely standard to me. So I don't know why that would raise an eyebrow in the first place. So I think if you're concerned about people knowing that you're taking notes, I would say just do it on some kind of electronic device where you could just as easily be playing Candy Crush or something. And I don't think anyone's going to bat an eye that you're like on your phone, even in between hands. Like, people are not paying that much attention to what you're doing, where they're going to like spot the timing and be like, every time that guy plays a big pot, he takes out his phone and types something into his phone. Like, I don't think that's going to jump out at anybody, especially if you occasionally do things on your phone when you weren't just in a pot. So that's my answer in terms of how do you be surreptitious about it. In terms of how do you get down the important information, I think part of it is like getting clear on what the important information is in the first place. For me, I use a aggressive shorthand, so I abbreviate a lot of things. Here's an example of the kind of thing that I might write in my phone after a hand. CO75 76 heart, or actually it would be 76 HH BN, and what that means is the cutoff raised and I called with 76 suited on the button. And then I might say if another player called, like if the big blind called, I might also type BB, and that would indicate that the big blind called the raise. So I'm just kind of writing down the minimum amount of information that'll enable me to reconstruct the action later. I'm not writing paragraphs. I'm not writing down the cutoff, who had not played a hand in several orbits and seemed a little frustrated, opened with a quick raise to $8, and then the button, who was a blonde gentleman of about 35 years old. Like, I you know, a lot of that stuff is, even if it was like slightly relevant to your decision, I don't think it's probably worth including in your notes. You may remember it anyway. I mean, the real point of the notes for me is just to kind of jog my memory. Typically, I'm going to go over my notes pretty soon after the tournament, so I'm not usually that worried about whether or not my notes are going to make sense to me 6 months after the fact. That's not usually all that big of a deal. I also think, you know, the reason that you're going over your notes should really be to help you figure out how you're going to play a similar spot in the future. So although a read might be very relevant for how you play this particular situation, like, you know, you 3-bet ace king and your opponent called and then the flop came queen 9-5 and you were wondering, you know, what you should do or something, your read on a particular opponent might have had a lot to do with what you chose to do in that hand. But this is a spot that you're going to run up against in the future against all sorts of different opponents. Like, this is not the last time that you're going to 3-bet ace king and miss the flop. So what you really want to do is not figure out how should you have played the hand against Joe Schmo that you might never see again, or even if you are going to see him again, that's not still not really the point. The point is to figure out, you know, if I don't know how to make this decision about whether or not to bet the flop, I need to get more clear on that. And what you really need to record is, you know, what do you need to investigate? Like, that's the question you're trying to answer for yourself is, what do I need to look into about this hand? And I think this gets into a bigger issue that people have with studying, which is that I think too often people are trying to get resolution on hands that they've already played rather than learn something from those hands that will enable them to play future hands better. And I do understand this impulse. I understand the way a hand can kind of stick in your craw and it can be difficult to move on and you're in some cases even losing sleep wondering like, oh, should I have called that river bet? You know, and I can see the psychological relief that's provided by getting an answer to that question. But at the same time, I think if you're going to play poker, you have to accept there are going to be unanswerable questions like that. You're not going to know for sure. Like, poker is not a game that's about certainty. And even if your opponent shows you the cards afterwards, you know, I'm sure you've all seen this. Many of us have been this person at some point, you know, begging to know, did you have it? Did you have it? Did I make the right fold? You show your hand, hoping that your opponent is going to show her hand. All of that, I think, is just chasing after an illusion, right? The idea that you can be sure you made the right play. Even if your opponent shows you a bluff and you folded, that still doesn't necessarily mean that you made the wrong play, right? That just means he was bluffing this time. I remember there was a tweet, I believe it was from Terrence Chan a few years ago. I don't think Terrence does a lot of tweeting anymore. I don't think he plays a lot of poker anymore, but there was a tweet from Terrence Chan a few years ago where he said something along the lines of he always thought it was funny if he like tanked for a long time before folding and then his opponent showed him a bluff. So he was like, well, yeah, I realized there was like a good chance you were bluffing. That's what I was thinking about. And the fact that you happen to have a bluff this time, you know, I'm not just trying to guess what are the two cards that are face down on the table right now. Typically, you don't have enough information to determine that. You know, to reach that level of specificity about your opponent's holding. What you're trying to think about is your opponent's entire range and whether or not it makes sense for you to call against that range. So just finding out which hand in his range he had this time really doesn't tell you what you should have done anyway. I mean, if there were some way that your opponent could honestly and accurately convey to you what his range in that situation would have been, then I suppose you could get some certainty as to whether or not you made the right play, but they can't. Even if you ask them, they can't. I mean, I think, A, they might lie to you, but B, I just don't think people are self-aware enough where in most cases, if someone, you say, oh, look, I folded this. Do you think I should have done that? You know, why don't you write down all of the hands that you would have played the way that you did? And we'll see. Even if they did that, I think most people aren't capable of actually doing that. Like, I don't think they could tell you what are all the hands they would have played that way. So you're not going to be sure. There's going to be a lot of moments in your poker career where you're not sure that you're making the right decision, you're not sure that you made the right decision, and you never will be sure. And maybe that sounds scary, but I think that you have to accept that that's true. And I think that once you do accept that that's true, you can stop torturing yourself with that question of, what should I have done? Okay, somehow this started as a strategy discussion about taking notes, which I guess my point is the reason to take notes is not to just try to get closure on a hand that you already played. Like, what you really need to figure out is, why did I not know what to do in this situation? Is this a situation that's likely to recur? What are the features of this situation that made it difficult for me to find the right play or to find a play that I was comfortable with? And how can I study this situation so that the next time it comes up, I'm better equipped to deal with this? And then it may not be terribly important whether you were the button or the cutoff. It might be not terribly important whether the original raiser was under the gun one or under the gun two. I mean, the point is an early position raised, you three bet from late position, even whether you had ace king or ace queen, whether or not it was suited, those things might not be terribly important. Maybe you're gonna three bet both of them. And the point is you three bet, you missed the flop, and you weren't sure whether or not you should have bet. And you can investigate. I mean, you can change all of those variables. Anything where you don't get down the answer, just treat it as a variable and say, okay, I didn't record the exact stack size. So let's see. I can look at, should I cbet if stack size, if the stack to pot ratio is 1? Should I cbet if the stack to pot ratio is 3? Should I cbet if the stack to pot ratio is 7? You can just investigate all three of those situations. If you don't know the answer to any of them, they're all valuable to investigate. So that's what I advise, is take notes with an eye towards what you need to improve. And the more that you can try to think about what made this situation difficult for me and get away from the just trying to reassure yourself that you made the right play or just have any kind of like certainty. I just think that's a word that needs to come out of your poker vocabulary. Let's talk to Mark Thompson.
It's definitely a software developer that plays poker. I started playing poker semi-seriously about three and a half years ago. I say semi-seriously, it was still kind of, very much at a kind of amateur level. But although funnily enough, a couple of years before I kind of started playing it seriously, I actually managed to cash in a tournament in Vegas. But looking back now, given I didn't really even know what was best, a flush or a straight when I sat down at the first table, I think it was luck.
It's a flush. A flush is better.
Thank you. I'll just get that straight now. Might have to make a few modifications in my software, but yeah.
How did you get started on the software development side of things? I mean, just as a developer generally, not with this app in particular.
Oh, I see. I'm now 44, and I got a computer called a ZX Spectrum, which I think in the US there was an equivalent. It was called like a Timex 3000 or Timex 2000 or something. It was an 8-bit computer. And I got one, like I say, when I was 9 years old, and I first learned to program on that in BASIC. And I was just absolutely fascinated by the fact that I could plug it into my television in my mum and dad's living room, and I could get it to draw like spirals on the screen and get it to print out text on the screen. I was just hooked from then on, and I did play games on it as well, but I learned how to program and kind of never looked back, really. I think it was kind of inevitable that I would end up doing it at university, and then it would just become a career because it was just something I was drawn to, like a moth to a flame, really.
Would you say you were drawn to poker in the same way, or how'd you get involved with that?
So poker. I had played a little bit when I was a kid, just with friends, and when I was kind of a teenager, early 20s. But it was never Texas Hold'em. It was always the one where you got dealt the 5 cards and then you could change as many of the cards as you wanted and then you just made the best hand that you could. Mm. That was the only variant that we really knew existed at this point, 30 years ago or whatever. And so when I got a bit older, I had been to Vegas. As I mentioned, I managed to cash in a tournament, but it would, like I say, it was more luck than judgment, really. But I had played it. I had played Texas Hold'em a few times with friends. But then I just kind of decided, after I'd done quite well in that tournament, which at this point I didn't realize it was luck, I thought I must be really good at poker. So not realizing about variance and all the rest of it at this point. So I decided to start, I signed up for PokerStars and started playing online a little bit. And I very quickly realized that there was a lot more to this game than just you've got 2 cards and, you know, your opponent's got a couple of cards and you're going to try and make the best hand. A lot more to it. And I started doing things. I think I bought a book and I started listening to podcasts. In fact, your podcast was the first poker podcast I ever listened to, which in retrospect, I think might have been slightly jumping in at the deep end. I know at one point, I think I messaged one of you guys and I think I likened it to trying to start learning the basics of mathematics by diving straight into kind of differential calculus. That's kind of how it felt a little bit, because you were talking about concepts that I couldn't really even understand. But the fact that I stuck with it and I kept listening, and I would listen to episode after episode. And in the end, I just maybe started to get a slight grasp and a slight foothold on some of the stuff you were talking about. But I did realize that I was going to need probably some help with this. And I heard your episode, I think it was episode 181, so a good while ago now, where you had Ian Simpson on as a guest, who is obviously a professional poker player here in the UK and had done pretty well. Because he was a former teacher, I thought he might be quite good at tutoring me in poker. So I got in touch with him, and he was quite happy to help me out, and I had a few lessons with him. And in one of the lessons I had with him, he recommended that I read Poker's 1% by Ed Miller, which I did. I got hold of that book and I read it because he sort of knew I was quite into the kind of mathematical side of stuff, and was quite analytical about the way I was trying to approach this. So I think he thought that might be a good way to try and approach the game. And I did start trying to implement what Ed says in the book, but I think I sort of realized that it was going to take a lot of off-table work to do, to actually work through all hands manually. You know, obviously Ed advocates that you try on average and bet 70% on the flop and 70% on the turn and 70% on the river, and you should have a bluff to value ratio on the flop of 2-1 and so on. And trying to work out how to do that in live play was obviously going to be very difficult for me as an amateur, a very early green amateur. So I knew I was going to have to do lots of off-table work, but I kind of didn't want to spend the time doing it, really, because it was going to take maybe like an hour or an hour and a half to analyze one single hand. Mm. And I thought I could probably better use that time to try and create some software to help me be able to do this more quickly, because I did try and find software out there to see if there's anything that could help me. And obviously there's stuff like Poker Stove, which is great at trying to look at, you know, hands versus hands or ranges versus ranges. But trying to break a range down into the individual component hands and then go from there, I found that tricky to find anything to help me with. And anything like solvers or anything like that, I didn't think were going to help me, really. So I just started, you know, developing a bit of software to try and help me with this. And it kind of went from there, really. At first, I wanted to try and come up with something that would rank hands. So you would be able to come up with ranges. So you would put your range in and you put the villain's range in, and then it would try and work out the value of your hands. Initially, it was actually against a random hand, the value of each hand in your range against a random hand, because to try and do the calculations against an opponent's range was taking a very long time with the algorithm, the way I had it at that point. And I actually got some help from Nate at this point, which thanks, Nate, for all your help on this, by the way. It's been very instructive to have someone from an early stage of this project who really knew what they were talking about, because, you know, as I got deeper and deeper into it, I kind of realized that, as often with very complex things, you realize there's far more you don't know than you do know the deeper you get into something like this. And one of the things that Nate pointed out to me was that just looking at kind of hot and cold equities only gets you so far, because obviously you've got to try and play the flop and then play the turn and then play the river, and it can be about things like, you know, how your hand might improve and things like that. So, you know, I kind of went off on a bit of a tangent on that, but then realized I was going to have to make it work in a slightly different way. So at that point, the software began to evolve into something else. I sort of realized that trying to follow this, at first I thought what Ed Miller had said in his book was kind of a methodology, but I began to realize it was more of a framework, really. It was more of an approach for trying to think about how to approach poker rather than be too specific about things. And I realized that I was going to need to broaden this software out into something that you could fit any sort of framework into, really, if it's going to work for me. And at this point, I was also starting to get an inkling that maybe other people could use this as well, because it's something I've found with software projects over the years. I used to run another company which worked to do with energy efficiency in buildings. And sometimes we'd be developing in-house software we're going to use for ourselves for consultancy, and we'd realize that actually other people might want to buy this software as well and might want to use it. And I started to get a feeling that might be the case with this software. So I just realized I've talked a lot here, actually.
That's why we brought you here.
It's fair enough. It just kind of feels a bit like a lecture at the moment. I'm happy to kind of tell you how it kind of, what it kind of evolved into. At first, I did start going down a bit of a rabbit hole with kind of artificial intelligence.
That was literally going to be I was like, well, I guess if I have to break this up by asking Mark a question, maybe I'll ask why he didn't employ artificial intelligence.
So I did start down that road. I mean, artificial intelligence was one of the modules I did at university, although I hadn't really thought about it for probably over 20 years when I got to the point of thinking about how it might apply to this. So I was kind of dragging out my old university books and mugging up on it online and so forth. But I started to realize that if I was going to go down that route, there's a reason why people spend years and PhDs in areas like that. I was actually able to get it to pick pretty good hands about 90% of the time, but getting that last 10% was the really problematic bit. The more time I spent on that area, the more diminishing the returns were. I may return to that eventually at a later date. In fact, I showed Nate an early version of the software where that was kind of working on it. It was trying to tell you which hands to pick, which hands would be the best in certain spots. And I was kind of quietly impressed with kind of how well it was doing in some respects, but there were definitely some hands it was picking where you were just looking at it thinking, nah, that's got the wrong end of the stick there. And the more you have to start putting kind of, special rules in for edge cases, the more complicated this thing gets. So I kind of parked that. At this point, I've got some professional poker players involved as consultants to help me test it and also the ideas behind it more thoroughly. I developed the idea of different types of equities. So what I refer to as river equity, which is actually what poker players generally just refer to as equity. But I was specifically thinking about when it gets to the river. But I also had this idea of current equity, which is a kind of hypothetical concept of if you were to stop the hand right now, how strong would your hand be against the opponents? And the reason why that was useful is not so much because you're going to stop the hand now, because you're not going to stop the hand now. You don't get to showdown until the river, obviously. But I think it's quite a good way of trying to work out how likely your hand is to improve or unimprove by the river in a kind of mathematical way. So if your current equity was, say, 70% and your river equity is 60%, then your improvability is actually minus 10%. It's going to degrade by about 10% given an average turn and river cards that would come. I also made sure that at this point you were comparing ranges, all the individual hands in your range, you are comparing against the villain's range. So it was no longer against a random hand. And that required me to generate something like 70 gigabytes worth of flop calculations, which also use the kind of form of compression on that takes into account the fact that if you've got a flop that's like, you know, ace, king, queen of diamonds, that's functionally the same as ace, king, queen of hearts. If the cards that you've got are both hearts versus both diamonds and so on, there's all kinds of ways in which you can reduce the problem space by looking at that. Otherwise, it would have been probably over a terabyte worth of data. So, but that's all kind of on the server in order to speed up the flop calculations, because they were originally taking maybe a couple of minutes to run through a flop calculation, which might not sound like very long, but if you're trying to get kind of quick answers here, it was far better to do all that stuff pre-calculated, and now it takes typically less than a second, depending on how big your ranges are. The turn and river calculations are still done live, as it were, but they only take maybe a second, or in some cases half a second anyway, because there's just far fewer permutations they've got to game out. I also started to explore how to kind of parse and analyze hand histories in order to be able to extract useful data such as heat maps for all the positions that you are in pre-flop when you open, and also all the positions that you're in when you're calling or raising pre-flop versus where the villain would be. And so it kind of gives you a grid of like 13 by 13 grid, that the typical starting hands grid, but it will actually shade in the different blocks, the different grid squares on that, darker if you've opened with hands more often, or lighter if you've opened with them less often, and with a little slidey bar to allow you to kind of knock out hands that you might not have opened with very often. For example, one of my ranges had me opening with queen three offsuit, which was kind of in the middle of a sea of white. There were no other hands around it that were being opened, but for some reason I must have been on tilt or something that day. So it just gives you an idea as well of which hands you are actually opening with versus which hands you think you're opening with. Because I did some work with Ian early on when I was getting lessons from him about my opening range, and I'd done quite a lot of work on what my opening range should be. But then when I had a look at what my opening range actually was, it was sometimes quite variant from it. And I was sometimes opening a bit looser than I thought, and sometimes I was folding hands I maybe shouldn't have been folding.
What's that saying?
And
the everybody's got a plan until they get punched in the face.
Exactly. You think you know how to handle it, yeah, until it happens. Yeah, I mean, I kind of did all that work with it as well. And obviously, I know, like, in reality, you might have different opening ranges for different spots and stuff. But this was when I was playing at the same level online, and it was the same situation every time. So there wasn't really any excuse for me to be randomly opening with very weird hands. I also found a way of crunching the big data from the hand histories to be able to extract information about how often the player pool was opening and calling and raising in different spots, you know, in different positions. So I was able to look and think, okay, so at this level, the player pool are opening 24% of the time from the hijack, for example. Or when someone opens from the hijack, they are calling 11% of the time, and they're re-raising 7% of the time if they are in the cutoff, for example. And that kind of helped me to start putting villains on ranges more, because you're more able to have a look at that and think, okay, so they probably raise these sorts of hands, and they probably call with these sorts of hands. Which I found very useful, because although I have used heads-up displays in the past, they're very specific to specific villains. And quite often you don't have enough hands on villains to be able to work out, for it to be statistically significant enough. Whereas if you look at a kind of player pool level, it's probably kind of the equivalent of, you know, you might walk into a poker room you've played in lots of times before, and you might sit down at a table and you don't really know many of the people at the table, but you just sort of know at that, in that card room, the players that typically play in this card room typically have these characteristics. It's a little bit like that. You're able to kind of see how the players at the level that you play at, when you pull the hand histories in and analyze them, typically play in different spots.
Yeah, and that's a big deal, I think, because it's a common excuse that people, I mean, my experience anyway, you know, working with less sophisticated poker players, you know, people love to make the excuse of like, oh, I'd never played with this guy before, so I had no idea how he played, or, you know, I didn't have any reads because I'd never met him before or something. And there's so much information that you, and it's far from perfect, but I mean, you do have access to a lot of information. I mean, some of which, you know, based on your opponent's appearance or other stuff that you don't have access to when you're playing online. But this, you know, what you're calling population tendencies, and I've heard some other people mention that concept as well. That, I mean, I think a lot of people, better players in particular, are doing that in the background. They are kind of constantly making assumptions about either what do most tournament players do, or what does the average recreational tournament player do, what does the average East Coast versus West Coast player do, young versus old, or just in general, like what kinds of mistakes are common in poker. I mean, I think some of this happens in an evolutionary way, like especially like you're mentioning in a small card room or something. A lot of people are playing with the same people day in and day out, and they're each other's primary or only source of poker information. So over time, they all kind of start playing like each other, or if anything, maybe evolving a little bit to exploit each other, but they're not really bringing in a lot of new ideas elsewhere. And so I think you can get these little like micro ecosystems of poker tendencies. But then there's also, you know, at a broader level, this kind of stuff is happening. It used to be even more dramatic, where like after Harrington on Hold'em came out, everyone starts continuation betting a lot more than they used to, and you can sort of say like this is a population tendency. Like now everyone, people who have read that book, you know, do a lot of continuation betting, and if you have an idea of what kind of poker information people have access to, you can make some assumptions about how they're going to play despite having never met them before. And I think, you know, what you're calling a population tendency is a reasonable proxy for that, or the most reasonable proxy you can get when you're playing online.
Yeah, and I think it's very interesting kind of salient point that you made there about, you know, a professional player might kind of know a lot of this stuff intuitively and kind of know how to go about either deriving that information or working out that information based on what they've seen. But the kind of poker player that I was when I first started and when I first started developing this software, and kind of to an extent the kind of poker player I still am, because I'm still, you know, very much at the amateur, getting better at an improving amateur level, is that one of the things that this software does is I think it helps people be able to think about poker and take decisions using the information it's got, the player pool stuff and the equities and so forth, in a way that's more congruent with how a professional might take those decisions. So it's kind of trying to take people who are kind of improving amateur players, but move them up a few levels so that they're thinking about this more like the way professionals would, and giving them tools to help them do it. I mean, certainly for me, I found that it's improved my game a lot. And I know that the people who've kind of helped me develop it and test it, and some of the early users we got some feedback from, have definitely found that that's the case, that it's helping them to just make better decisions. This player pool stuff as well, I was referring to it for pre-flop, but we have information on the flop as well. And it's more nuanced even than you get in the pre-flop area, because on the flop, it will vary bet sizes as well. So you can have a look at it and it will give you graphs and charts to show you if you bet a certain amount, say between 60 and 70%, or you can kind of vary the size of the widths of these bars depending on how much data sample you've got. It will tell you for a flop of this texture. So for example, a flop that might be, say, a king high flop with only one Broadway card that is flush drawing but isn't straight drawing, depending if you've got enough hands, and you might need a few tens of thousands or a few hundreds of thousands of hands in your hand history for this. But it will tell you that if you bet out of position, say 65% pot, that players are going to call, 42% of the time, they're going to raise you 8% of the time, and they're going to fold whatever else is left percent of the time. And I found that, and that the early adopters of this have found that really useful, because when you're trying to work out on the flop, if you're going to make a bet and then your opponent, say, calls you or raises you, it helps you to put them on a range, because you've already got a frequency that you can use to then think, okay, now what hands would I fill this frequency with? But like you say, a professional might look at that and think, well, I know that, I'm going to get raised X percent of the time here, and therefore I can kind of put my opponent on a range. But someone who's kind of learning and trying to get better and improving, I think it's really useful for them. Although, interestingly, some of the pros that I've had involved in this project have also talked about how helpful it is for them as well. And some of the tools that this software has got has kind of made them think about the game in ways that maybe they hadn't really thought about before, certainly to do with like range versus range stuff that it has on the flop, turn, and river.
Well, I think a danger that professionals run into, I mean, this is certainly the case for me, is sometimes it's difficult to access the thought process of less sophisticated players, where you kind of have an idea of what, I mean, sometimes your idea might even be wrong, but even if you're right about how a certain situation ought to be played or what a certain player's incentives ought to be or are, those players don't always follow those themselves. So there's many situations where I think, well, he's got to have some bluffs in this situation, and like, in fact, he does not. many people don't. And so I think like being able to do that kind of gut check or like test that sort of thing with data, it can be, especially going back and forth between playing with different types of players or something, I think can be quite useful.
Yeah. Well, actually, on that subject, I mean, one of the things that the software has is when you work through scenarios, it saves them all, it stores them all. This is, just to be clear, it's a piece of Windows software at the moment. So you install it on a Windows PC, and it's client server as well. So most of the calculations and all the flop data lookup is all done on the server. So it's a fairly thin client thing, and it doesn't really rely on you having a particularly fast processor to be able to use. But it stores the scenarios on the server. Almost everything you do is stored on the server, so you can use it on multiple machines quite easily. But it stores the scenarios, and it does it in such a way as it uses a tree structure. So if you want to come back to an earlier decision point and then branch off in a different way, so let's say you're on the flop and then you bet a certain amount, and then you then kind of followed that through, and it might be you're following a real life scenario, which the software supports as well. Actually, it allows you to pick out scenarios from your hand history, and it will tell you all the decision points along the way, so you can try and stick to the actual decision points, you can deviate from that if you want.
Can I take the opportunity to ask a slightly different sort of question?
Yep.
So you're a software guy, you're not a poker guy primarily. Yeah. One feature of you that I think is interesting is that you're pretty determined. A lot of people have tried to write poker software. You sort of stuck with it and committed to it in a pretty extreme way. There are other projects in your life that you've also committed to. You've run a marathon, yes?
Yeah, I ran the London Marathon, and having seen me on Skype a few times, Nate, I think you'd probably be too polite to say I don't really have a runner's build.
I would say that I saw a photo of you before your training, and you certainly did not have a runner's build at that point.
I didn't really even when I ran the actual marathon, to be fair. I did lose a few pounds. But yeah, that was something I was doing. There was a charity that was very close to my heart. We had a family tragedy several years ago, and it was raising money for a charity that's linked to, very closely to that tragedy. And yes, I was just very determined to do it. And I kind of, you know, when I first applied through the charity, I thought, oh, they won't pick me, but they did pick me. And as soon as they picked, like, oh, I've got to actually do this now. So I ran 200 yards and found I couldn't go any further because my lungs were burning. But yes, just over the course of several weeks, several months, I just kind of built my range up until I could actually run 26 miles, although it did take me 6.5 hours. It was a very plodding pace, and at one point I was overtaken by a man in high heels and suspenders. But, you know, I got round, and as long as you get round within 8 hours, you get your medal, and they can't take that off me. So, yeah. One of my brothers regularly says to me, you don't do things by halves, Mark. You know, when you start doing something, you go full in. It's like when I started, I became like an amateur political blogger about 10 years ago, and I quite quickly started doing podcasts, and then I started appearing on the radio, and before you know it, I'm on the radio on the BBC World Service on election day in 2010, when Gordon Brown, the Prime Minister, had come out of 10 Downing Street and had announced that he was going to stand down as Prime Minister. And then the host of the show, that was probably being listened to by millions of people all around the world, threw back to me as if I was somehow their political editor. So Mark Thompson, what do you make of this then? And I had to kind of try and break down a very fast moving complicated political. And it's like, I don't quite know how I ended up in that situation, but I do now often find myself rung up by radio stations to talk about politics. And again, it's kind of my nature. Once I get into something, I kind of, if I'm not going into it 100%, I kind of get bored of it. So I just kind of focus on it. And it's the same with this poker thing. I know a lot more about poker now than I did. I'm probably now a very good amateur player, because just by writing this software and by having played so much and having had so many discussions with professional players and semi-professional players, it probably is how it's turned out for me. Probably if I turned around now and said I actually want to play poker professionally, I'd probably be able to have a stab at it now. I probably wouldn't do that from where I am for various reasons, but you probably advise me not to be honest, Andrew, from kind of things I've heard you say about advising other people trying to get into it. It's definitely not an easy thing to do, to be a professional poker player. But
But the sort of direction, like, as you know, one thing we talk about on the show is like people who do poker and do other things also, why poker? And I mean, that, given, you know, that's your personality type, that's how you approach things, you know, yeah. Given all that, why poker?
Yeah, I mean, poker's the latest thing. So I got into amateur dramatics about 20 years ago, and suddenly I was like, you know, in several different amateur dramatics plays in quick succession. That was kind of my hobby at that time. I tried to learn to play the guitar around about the same time that I was learning about starting to do the political blogging. The guitar fell by the wayside, but at some point I might take that up again. And, you know, poker really appeals to me in a number of different ways. The first thing is it's quite heavy on the maths. I think lots of people I speak to in like card rooms, I'm not sure do appreciate the mathematical side too much. I think they think more about the, you know, it's about bluffing and it's about psychology and it's about, you know, trying to psych the other person out, which is obviously part of it, but it is underpinned by this pretty solid mathematics. And I think given my background in computers and maths at university, I think that was one of the things that appealed to me. But also the fact that, you know, you can try and look at other people at a table and try and work out, you know, what is their game? What are they doing? Would they do that with this hand? I find all of that kind of really interesting as well. And I just find it a very pleasant way to spend a few hours, to sit there with a bunch of people. It depends. Sometimes you're at a table and you're with people and they're not that interesting, or you don't like them very much. But sometimes you're at tables and you have all sorts of fascinating conversations with people, and you meet people from all sorts of different walks of life, especially if you go to, like, I've done a few times, I've gone to like tournaments in, you know, other cities and other towns in the UK. And I've even been to Vegas a couple of times now since I've got better at poker. And I just find it fascinating from that perspective.
Yeah, cool, thanks. I mean, I guess you're also a software professional.
Yeah,
I'm a software professional. Are there connections between, like, specifically your craft, like the craft that you chose to make your career, and sort of that part of your personality, the sort of intense all-in kind of part of your personality?
I think so, yes. I mean, I think that being a software developer, it depends how you do it. I know that there's been all sorts of moves in recent years to like pair programming and group programming and stuff like that, but I'm quite old school. I could say I've been programming now for over 30 years and over 20 years professionally, and it's quite a solitary pursuit. I will sit there for hours on end in front of the computer trying to get it to do what I want it to do. And that, I think, takes quite a lot of focus. I think even some people who might be technically capable of doing it might not be temperamentally capable of doing it, because it really does require a lot of focus. You know, you hear about, you know, chess grandmasters where during the course of a tournament they'll lose several pounds in weight because of the amount of energy they've expended in thinking about what they're doing. And I think sometimes with software development it can be similar. I mean, this project I've worked on here, the Kicker Poker project, is the most complicated single piece of software I've ever developed. I've worked on more complicated pieces of software, you know, with colleagues, that usually software that's already been in existence, and I've been adding bits to it or fixing bugs or whatever, but from start to finish this is the most complicated by far that I've ever worked on. And it has taken periods of time where I will be sitting in front of a computer for 10, 12, 14 hours with brief breaks for, you know, biological reasons, but, you know, kind of ongoing, on an ongoing basis. And I think that does appeal to me. There's a real, I get a real buzz out of spending that amount of time and then getting the finished product and then seeing other people being able to use it and get something out of it. It is really rewarding to do that. And it is a real reward for the amount of time and effort that you've spent doing it, I think.
Very neat. Yeah, I mean, I got that impression when we met up and you were making like Windows desktop software. Like that's a platform choice you made that maybe suggests that you're experienced in this. Do you regret that? Do you think that was the right choice?
What, for making it Windows based?
Yeah, and not cloud based from the start, like Windows based, yeah.
Yeah, so we've sort of ended up with a hybrid now where it is Windows-based, but quite a lot of the stuff does happen in the cloud. And I mean, the main reason why we went down this road is because I am a Windows software developer, and had I wanted to go down a web-based route, I probably would have had to pull other people in, get other people involved. And just the way things were at the time and the kind of budget that we had for doing this, that was just the quickest way to get to market. But depending on how things go with this product, I mean, we do have earmarked as a possibility being able to support other platforms and maybe go fully cloud-based further down the line. I think it just depends on kind of how things go with it. But I think lots of people who would want to use a product like this would already use something like Poker Tracker, or maybe some, you know, solving type software and things like that. And therefore, I think most people will already have a Windows machine at their disposal to be able to use this software initially. Although obviously the advantages you would get if it was cloud-based is it would work across all platforms and all different types of browsers. So like I say, it's something we might think about in the future. But another advantage of having it Windows-based is that you can cache all of these hand history information on the local machine and have it respond instantaneously. So there's little slidey bars you've got for like the hand histories, and when you're trying to adjust the size of the bars for the bet sizes and so forth for the player pool tendencies, all happens almost instantaneously because we've got a very fast cached copy of what can be, you know, hundreds of megabytes worth of software of data stored on the local machine. So there are pluses and minuses to both paths there, I think.
So you said earlier that like something that had been developed internally turned into a big software project before. This project also evolved where sort of minor features of it became sort of the star of the show. You know, more pivots ahead. Like what's you know, from a sort of the future is uncertain kind of perspective. Like what's next for the software and for your and for your software career?
So yeah, I mean, what I'm doing at the moment is I've solely been focusing on this for the last, well, year or so. I mean, I had a job, a reasonably well-paying job, but I quit that job in order to develop this software because I really did think that the more I'd got into it, the more I'd understood about what I was going to be able to make it do. And I couldn't really see in the marketplace anything that specifically did what this software does, as in helping you to understand more about the equities of the individual hands in your range versus a villain's range and all of the hand history stuff. There are maybe bits and bobs of software out there that do parts of what this software does. I mean, I mentioned Poker Stove earlier on, and obviously that's really good at looking at, you know, your hand or a range at a range level against another range and looking at the equities. But obviously this breaks down things a lot more than that. So we've launched the software. It was launched just over a week ago. We have obviously had some people initially download it and install it and are currently using it. On an ongoing basis, we're going to support this software and we're going to gather the feedback and add more features as and when. There are all kinds of different ways in which this software could go. As I've learned from many years of software development, sometimes the direction in which software goes once you start getting user feedback is a little bit difficult to predict. It may be that there are some features that people get a lot of use out of and we might further develop those. It may be that people say to us, oh, well, actually, it would be really useful if we could do this sort of analysis, say, on the turn or on the river. And we may want to look at stuff like that. It may be that people start to say, it would be great if we had something like this for Omaha. Or Omaha High Low, in which case maybe we might start to branch out in that direction. It's difficult to predict at the moment, but
first to say it would be great if we had something like this for Omaha or for Omaha High Low.
I'll add it to the list then, Andrew. One of the problems with Omaha is that the numbers of different permutations and combinations is obviously a lot higher than
yes,
with Texas.
Yes, this is why it would be great if we had something like this for Omaha or Omaha High Low.
I will definitely bear that in mind. Yeah, I will add you to the list. You're not the first person to have made the suggestion, and we'll certainly bear that in mind. A really useful addition to this software, because I kind of alluded to it earlier on, but it is a really, I found it really helpful. I know the feedback I've had, other people have found it really helpful, is when a colleague of mine who's on the project suggested that we add these histograms in order to have a look at range versus range x-ray. I think he'd heard someone talk about it on a podcast, but they were talking about it in a slightly different context. So what we did was we developed these histograms where you have the equity of your hands are kind of broken down into different bars. So any hands that have between 0 and 5% equity are in the first bar and 5 to 10% equity are in the second bar and so on, all the way up to between 95 and 100% equity. And it puts all of the hands in your range in those bars as histograms are supposed to be in the proportion of how they appear in your data set. And then they do the same for the villain, and the two histograms are on top of each other. And it just very quickly helps you see the shape of your range against the villain's range. I found that very useful, but some of the pros that have helped me develop this have said how useful they found that to help visualize what a range versus a range actually looks like, and that they haven't really seen that before. And another thing that they said was that would be really helpful in kind of coaching, you know, when they're coaching students, because trying to explain concepts like the equity of your range versus the equity of the villain's range, I think can be quite tricky to do. So the fact that, you know, it's got that there kind of in your face, I think has been really helpful. And it may be that we do further development in those areas. You know, maybe we want to do more graphs like that. Maybe we want to make those graphs more interactive and all sorts of things like that. You know, there's all kinds of ways in which this could go, I think.
I think what you're talking about is even a little more sophisticated than this, but I mean, there's not a lot of things that I would point to in my career as like very specific aha moments where I just kind of had a flash of realization or something. But there is one, and this is probably even a Card Runners video, which gives you an idea of how long ago this was. But someone was looking at the equity of different hands, and I guess this is using, I believe, two dimes is the feature that has this this functionality. So you could look at the equity, how the equity of a hand was distributed across a variety of flops. So this is in some ways the opposite of what you're saying. It's, you know, the equity of one hand across all possible flops rather than the equity of all hands in your range across a given flop. But
I see.
The same sort of idea. And you know, he was showing the difference between like you know, hand like A6 offsuit, if you're defending from the big blind versus a button raise, like, you know, A6 offsuit has a good amount of equity against a button opener's range, but that equity, like, there's very few flops where A6 has like just a ton of equity, right? It's pretty difficult to flop that well. So there's many boards where like ace high is the best hand, but it doesn't have a whole lot of value. It has like 40 to 60-ish% equity on a lot of flops. And then if you look at a hand like Pocket Twos, there's a huge number of flops where Pocket Twos has quite poor equity, you know, 30% or less. And then there's a few flops where Pocket Twos has like 80 to 100% equity. And and the person's point was, you know, this is a much easier hand. Like, this is why this hand is easier to play after the flop, right? Like, so I already knew like Pocket Twos is kind of an easier hand to play than A6 offsuit is. And I was in the habit of calling with twos and not with A6 offsuit, but I had never really seen it put together in that way. And I imagine this histogram feature that you're talking about would produce a similar sort of realization through visualization.
I think that's right. I mean, the spots that I've sort of seen, because obviously I've had to put quite a lot of hands through this software whilst I've been testing, and we started to get feedback from the people who are using it as well now in this respect. And it is a really good way to be able to see things like a polarized range, you know, where you'll have big peak at the bottom end and then it kind of dips down and then there's a big peak at the top end, you know, a kind of reverse bell curve effect where you can see that, you know, you've got a lot of really strong hands and a lot of really weak hands. But sometimes you can see quite surprising effects, and it doesn't not necessarily intuitive. You maybe wouldn't have realized that the shape of your range may look like this, where you've got maybe like a kind of peak around 40% and then another peak around 70%. And when you look at the villain's range, you can see you've got a whole bunch of hands that are significantly ahead of where the villain's range peaks, even though when you were to look at the raw equity information, which is a fairly scalar indication, a fairly blunt indication of range versus range, you wouldn't have been able to see that level of nuance in it. So you know, I think this could be a real boon for people who want to analyze how their range plays against villains' ranges and find spots where they may be able to do something that they may otherwise not have thought of, because when they think about their range, they may be thinking about it at a kind of higher level, at a level of, you know, what sort of equity does my entire range have against the villain's range? But this allows you to break that down and look at it in a lot more detail. Like I say, I've certainly found it an eye-opener in terms of how it's made me start to look at the game. And I have even found when I'm playing sometimes live, you know, in an actual card room or even online, where I find myself looking at spots thinking, I know the shape of this range I've got here against this villain in ways that just wouldn't have happened if I'd not had this software and been able to use it.
The other thing that that you mentioned that I think, I mean, it's a concept, and honestly, it's probably somewhat new even for me to be thinking in quite these terms, and I guess I'll be curious to talk to you a little bit about how exactly you use the term. But you mentioned like improvability, essentially, like how, which, if I'm understanding correctly, it's basically just saying how will the equity of your range now compare to the equity of your range on a future street, or sorry, the equity of your hand now. Is it? Yeah, it's hand.
Yes,
it's for a particular hand.
That's right. So it's actually both. So we do it at a range level, but we also do it at hand level. And I find it much more useful at the individual hand level within the range. I mean, one of the things that we try to kind of make sure people understand when they're using the software is you're thinking about your range. You can put your individual hand in if you're looking at a scenario you played, but you should kind of forget about that and look at the range. And that was something I found really hard to grasp early, you know, when I was new to playing poker. But yes, it is. It's looking at it mainly at the hand level.
And one of the reasons why I think this is so significant is that so many people get started either playing tournaments or playing cash games where they're buying in relatively short. Like, even if they're, you know, even like if you're playing cash, even 100 big blinds is kind of a short buy-in these days. But, you know, many people are buying in for, you know, 40 or 50 big blinds when they start playing. And it's also, you know, people learn, it's a lot easier to learn play before the flop. I mean, someone just give you a chart and say, like, play these hands from these positions. And I mean, there's still a question, as you said earlier, of, you know, discipline and of actually doing that. But it's still a good deal simpler than playing later streets. So, you know, people, I think, get attached to thinking in terms of like pre-flop hands or hands on the flop. And when they start playing deeper, they really struggle with the idea of like, well, but I had the best hand, you know, before, or, you know, I was thinking like pocket aces is the kind of hand you want to slow play, which is true. Like, if you're very shallow, you are very happy. Like, you basically want any preflop action you can get, and you do kind of want to keep people in the pot, and there might even be room to like slow play aces on the flop, or even like, you know, flop sets and stuff. Just as you get deeper and deeper, you start to realize that like a flopped set, if you're 400 big blinds deep, still might not be that good for you by the time you get to the river. Like, there are many runouts where your hand is no longer going to be a value hand by the time you get to the river, and like, you have a lot of equity on the flop, and that's why you want to put your money in on the flop. You don't want to be waiting for later streets. I found as a coach, that's a concept that people really have a lot of trouble wrapping their head around, is the extent to which a hand's value can change from street to street. And not just because of the risk of getting drawn out on, but also just because of the risk of, you know, getting bluffed as well. If you are, even if you're holding a set and you're facing a large bet on the river, actually, I mean, this just came up kind of on our strategy segment last week, where we had a player who flopped flopped trips, and then like by the river, he was kind of questioning whether he should be calling a bet. I think it's that kind of idea of like what was a strong hand is not necessarily going to continue to be a strong hand all the way through to the river.
I think that's right. Yeah, and the reason why I kind of developed this idea of having your current equity, which then allows you to derive the improvability of each individual hand in your range, is because I was trying to find different sets of criteria for being able to sort the hands that you have in your range in different orders in the grid, where you're trying to pick your hands, you're trying to grab the hands that you want to bet or raise or call with, and trying to pick decent candidate hands for consideration for all the different baskets that you want to put the hands in. And it just gave me an extra metric to be able to utilize, because you can look at hands and say, well, that's got lots of equity. And you could even look at it and say, that's got lots of current equity, or it's got lots of nuts equity, as in the chance of it improving to a monster by the river. But I was just finding that there were some spots where when you've already picked a bunch of hands that are obvious that you're going to bet, or obvious you're going to check, or obvious you're going to mix up between bet and check because they're very strong or good draws or whatever, that sometimes you're left with, well, what am I going to do with these other hands? What are the criteria could I use for these hands? Well, in some cases, you've got hands that are reasonable now, but are going to degrade by 15 or 20% by the river, in which case, bet them now. Or you've got a hand that might improve, and therefore maybe you'd be more inclined to check it. I mean, you can obviously decide how you want to utilize that information yourself, but having extra metrics to be able to filter and sort by when you're trying to pick the hands just gave me more information as I was developing this thing to be able to make those decisions. Because as I said earlier on, you know, I'm an amateur player, and I was on a very steep learning curve, and just being able to get any extra bits of information that I could for things that perhaps for professional players might be more intuitive, I think was very useful for me. But again, I think could be very useful for, you know, coaching purposes, anyone wanting to learn. I mean, you can use the software to teach yourself to do that, but also, you know, if you have a poker coach, maybe this could be used in conjunction with a poker coach. Certainly some of the pros I've had testing this think that it has a lot of potential in that area.
Yeah, I can see that. And there's a related concept that I'm curious about as well, which is how a hand's equity how a hand's future equity may depend on whether or not one plays it aggressively. So I think like good examples of this can be straight draws when there's a flush draw on the board, for instance, or especially straight draws if there's like if the flop is all hearts, and you have something like an open-ended straight draw. So we might typically think, well, an open-ended straight draw, that's a good hand to play aggressively. You know, it's a classic semi-bluffing hand. If your opponent folds, great. If he doesn't fold, you have a chance of improving to a straight. But like the value of improving to a straight is typically going to be much higher if the flop action goes check, check. It's going to be worth a lot more to you to make a straight on a future street than if the action goes bet call on the flop. Partly because when a fourth heart does come, you know, like a quarter of your outs are going to put four hearts on the board, and it's going to be less likely that a straight is the best hand when that happens. But also, even when that doesn't happen, it's going to be harder for you to get value bets paid off if you do make your straight, because you'll have strengthened both your range and your opponent's range as a result of that bet. Is that kind of comparative analysis possible in Kicker to look and say, how will my equity, or how does the improvability of my hand change in a scenario where I've bet the flop versus one where I've checked the flop?
I mean, it doesn't exist per se in the features that we've got in the software at the moment, but you can actually use the software to game out different runouts. So you could try it on a situation where you then run through to a turn where a flush card comes in, and then compare it to a turn where a flush card doesn't come in, and the same all the way through to the river, where you can kind of see how it plays out, which kind of ties in with what I was saying earlier on about the ability for you to be able to go back to different decision points in the decision tree that you've taken, and then branch off in different directions, and then you can actually look at those the different results and compare them to see how things go. But one way in which if you've got an open-ended straight draw on, say, a monotone flop versus an open-ended straight draw on, say, a rainbow flop or a flop with the that was two-tone, is that because of the way the equities are calculated for all the hands in your range, it will an open-ended straight draw won't be considered as strong on a board that's all monotone than it would be on a board that was rainbow. So it's kind of giving you indications of, you know, the potential pitfalls you could fall into with those hands. And because that's against the opponent's range as well, if for some reason, you know, you had an opponent that you think might not have have flushes that often for some reason, maybe because of the way the preflop action's gone, or you know, for some reason you've got your opponent on a range that doesn't have as many flush possibilities, then obviously your straight's going to be worth potentially more in terms of its you know, its improvability and its nuts equity and so forth. But that is all built in. And if a turn card was to come, which was the flush card, obviously, you know, there's going to be potentially lots of hands in your opponent's range that are going to be way ahead of you at this point. In fact, you could be drawing dead at that point when you've hit your straight. So again, that's all built into the equities, which is something I've found very helpful all along the way, because, you know, the fact that this thing is based on the kind of underpinning mathematics of poker means that because of the way all these calculations have been done and that 70 gigabytes worth of data I talked about on the flop earlier on, it's all built in. So when you're trying to sort these hands in the grid and you're trying to work out what am I going to grab to stick in this basket, all of that stuff is all built in. So it kind of helps you to make those decisions and like I say, kind of make better decisions, because, you know, there'll be a few percentage points off that hand if it's a monotone flop, and it's just a kind of bit of a warning to be careful. The specific feature that you talked about, though, maybe that's another one of those things that we could look at for a future version, because it definitely sounds like something, you know, you'd want to think about, you know, about the difference between those scenarios you were describing in perhaps a more nuanced detail.
Nate, anything else you wanted to ask related to software development?
No, I got those out of my system earlier.
Sorry, Mark, were you going to jump in with something?
No, not really. No, I think I've talked a lot. I think I didn't want to bombard your listeners with kind of statistics, so I tried to steer clear too much of you know, of kind of specific numbers and stuff. But hopefully, you know, they'll have got an idea of you know, of what this is all about. There is just so people know, there's a free trial available for this for 14 days. So you can download it, install it on your Windows machine, have a play with it. You can upload up to 1 million hands to be analyzed, and then you get like a cached version of those hands on your machine that you can do all your hand history stuff with. If you go to the website, which is kickersoftware.com, you've got to type it in at the moment because we're pretty new. So if you type kicker space software into Google, you won't find us at the moment. Although, I don't know, maybe by the time this podcast is out, there are people listening to it, that might work. But if you type the URL in directly, there's a 25-minute video on the site which does an end-to-end, you know, takes you through right from the start all the way to analyzing a hand all the way to the river, and shows you all the features of the software. That's on the Using Kicker page. And if after 14 days people want to actually use the software, then there's a monthly license, which is pretty low. It's currently $12.50 a month, but if people put the code THINKING19 into the coupon code, they'll get a 30% discount on that for the monthly fee. So that's a special for your listeners, which I've set up for you. And if you want to follow us on Twitter, we're at @kickerpoker, where we'll be posting pretty regular content. We'll be producing videos and running through hands and so forth in the coming weeks and months. You know, people can actually see how we use the software and how they can get the most out of it. But I think, you know, if you want to give it a go, just download it and try the trial out and see how you get on. And we're here if, you know, if people need help or have got any feedback for us. Like our hopes come across in this podcast, you know, we're very keen on getting feedback and very eager to kind of take it to the next levels wherever they take us.
Excellent. If you've got another minute, I was going to ask if there's anything that you would identify as something that you think is important about UK politics that is not well understood outside of the UK, or specifically in the US, if you have a sense of that.
Yeah, so there probably is something, actually, which is that we don't have a written constitution. So something that you hear in American politics all the time is, well, you know, that's unconstitutional, or, you know, that's the Second Amendment, or that's the Fifth Amendment, or, you know, talking about Trump, maybe the 25th Amendment. We don't have anything like that here. So actually, our constitution is kind of infinitely malleable, and it's kind of up to the government of the day and the parliamentarians of the day to interpret that constitution to decide what they want to do. I mean, Tony Blair, who was a prime minister of ours for 10 years from 97 to 2007, was notorious for just kind of doing cabinet reshuffles and then just reinterpreting the constitution however he wanted to in the situation he was in order that he could appoint a certain person to a certain role, even though, like, that would be unconstitutional. And I think with what's going on with Brexit at the moment, it's really coming to a head now, because we're starting to realize as a country and as a kind of, you know, political entity that our country is, that there aren't any rules for navigating this situation. It's one of the reasons why it's become so chaotic and why no one really understands what's happening anymore, because there's no rule book we can go back to say, well, you're supposed to do this and you're supposed to do that. I mean, we do have bits of written constitution type stuff in different places. So there's this document called Erskine May, which was codified in about 1820, I think it was, that has bits and bobs of rules about how Parliament's supposed to work. But in some ways, I really envy your system, because at least in the end, whatever problems there are, you can come back to a document that says, this is what we are supposed to do. And I know constitutional scholars may argue about interpretation.
I was going to say, that's a pretty generous reading of how politics works in the United States.
No, I understand that a written constitution is not a panacea. But at the same time, it gives you an anchor. It gives you a kind of starting point. That you can see what was intended in certain situations, and then it's up to interpretation. But in our country, they just make it up as they go along, and it's been a somewhat unedifying spectacle to observe that in the last few months. I mean, I assume that you guys have kind of probably been semi-following what's been going on with this whole Brexit thing, because I think it's been such a big story. It's probably gone international now, hasn't it?
I mean, I would put the emphasis on semi for myself.
Fair enough.
I've been trying to follow it, but yes, big story, certainly. Yeah,
I saw a good piece on John Oliver a few weeks ago where he tried to unpack it for everyone. So, it's probably going to get bigger and bigger, because if we crash out with no deal, it's going to affect the entire world. You'll be displeased to hear. So let's all hope that doesn't happen.
Well, thanks so much, Mark, for taking the time to talk to us. Just for putting effort into it. I mean, I imagine, based on what you've said about the amount of time that you've put into this, that this is, despite the fact that you are charging money for it, is likely a passion project.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I couldn't have spent the time and effort and focus I'd done on this if I wasn't really, really passionate about it. I would have given up after a couple of weeks, to be honest. So, it's been great to see, you know, the take up that we've had so far and the feedback we've had from the people who've been using it so far. And you know, the more people who have a play with it and let us know what they think of it, the better, really. And we'll see how it goes. But thank you very much for having me on. As I say, I've listened to many, many episodes of your podcast over the years, and although I struggled to kind of, you know, grasp some of the concepts you talked about when I was less experienced, it's been a really good platform for me to get better and better. And some of the guests that you've had on have been fascinating to hear, you know, because you have a very good spectrum of different guests that cover all kinds of different areas, you know, software and people who've written books, but also, you know, people who have been professionals for many, many years. And it covers a, you know, it runs the gamut of all kinds of different people, and it's always interesting. And sometimes when I look at the show notes and I think, oh, not so sure about that, but when I actually listen, there's always something that you get out of the guests that you have, even when, you know, I might in advance think, I'm not so sure that you know, that one's going to work. You always get useful and interesting stuff out of people, and I guess I'm hoping some people will get useful and interesting stuff out of me, because they might look at the show notes for me and think, not so sure about that.
Well, I'm flattered that you stuck with it during the time when you felt like it was potentially over your head. That's to me the most flattering bit. So thank you.
No problem. It's a little bit like when my lungs were burning after the 200 yards, and I just kept going.
All right, good.
Well, pleasure to talk to you again, Mark.
And you, Nate. Thank you.
Good luck and take care.
Rain, cheers. Cold rain, tapping on my window. Feeling faint, feeling ashamed.
the devotion of a Carmelite, the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law? I know you